Hello, everyone. Welcome. You're listening to Germantown Community Radio, WRLGLP, at 92.9 FM in Northwest Philadelphia. Welcome to Vanessa's Money Hour, where I talk about tools and resources to help build financially healthy lives. I'm your host, Vanessa Lowe. This show airs every first and third Saturday of the month. I welcome your questions, guest suggestions, and feedback. You can email those to gtownmoneyhour@gmail.com. So I'm very excited today for this, now the third Saturday in April. Doesn't it feel like time is flying? I'm excited to welcome my guest, Edgar Villanueva. He is the author of a book called Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. Hey there, Edgar, can you hear us?
I can, hi.
Hi. All right. We need a little more volume, so I'm going to push you up a little bit. Say hello one more time.
Hey, good morning or afternoon now, everyone.
There we go. We've moved into the afternoon. Edgar, thank you so much for calling in. Edgar's in New York City, I believe, and I'm here on around the Germantown neighborhood, and we're excited to do this call today. I want to give a little background. So Edgar was actually in Philadelphia on, I'll call it his book tour, talking about the book a couple of months ago. I think it was in February. And it was co-sponsored by a group called Power that I've talked about on the show before. And also, I believe, by Philanthropy Network, right, Edgar?
I think so.
Yeah. It was a really good event. Lots of people came out. And all right, so let's go ahead and start jumping into it. We're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about Edgar. As in the conversations we've had and what I heard you talk about on the panel, I want to say congratulations on the book. It's really great. So it's really wonderful that it's now out there for people to consume and do things with. And we're going to talk about what people are doing with it. Is it okay to describe it as a loving call to action to your family, the foundation world? Would you say that's okay?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. I am bringing some critique to the field of philanthropy and social finance, but I work inside the sector. I've been working in philanthropy for 15 years, so I am bringing that perspective with the lens of love, because I think I do love this work. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to improve how we're doing the work.
Wonderful. And that's, I wanted to start because I know every time we talk and every time I hear you, it's like this is really about love and improving something that you love, which is this industry. So give us a little bit on your background, you know, sort of the growing up, and then how did you get involved in the foundation world?
Sure. So I am from North Carolina originally. I was born and raised there. I'm an enrolled member of a Native American tribe called the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina.
Edgar, we're losing your voice a little bit. Can you get a little closer to your phone?
Oh,
there
how
we
is
go.
That?
Much better, much better. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. So I was sharing that I am an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. We are a tribe that's situated in southeastern North Carolina with about 60,000 members. We are actually the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River. And so that growing up with that type of identity really shaped who I am as a person. My family came from poverty. We are basically living out every single day, sort of experiencing the trauma that exists in a lot of Native communities as a result of years and years of oppression. And so in my particular family, I was the first to graduate from high school and to sort of make it out of that cycle. So I stumbled into philanthropy. I'm a very much not the type of person you would traditionally find working at a foundation. Most of the folks who work at foundations are connected to wealth, especially in the family philanthropy arena. Most of the board members are family members and are people that they trust. And so I sort of stumbled into the space. I studied public health at the University of North Carolina. And upon graduating, I had worked in a number of nonprofit roles. And this particular foundation in North Carolina was looking to diversify their staff and to bring in someone from a different background, also a younger person. I was quite young at that time to be hired into my role. And so I kind of, you know, jumped in and took this position with the, you know, understanding that I would have access to and influence over millions of dollars of investment in community. And that was something that was really exciting for me, especially, again, coming from a history of not having access to resources or power in that way.
That's really interesting. Your first job out of college was giving away lots of money.
That's right. Out of graduate school, I had worked at a nonprofit full-time throughout undergraduate and graduate school, but my first job out of grad school, I was recruited to the foundation.
Got it. Right. Okay. So it's interesting because if you worked at a nonprofit, it sounds like maybe you were a little familiar with foundations. Is that true?
A little bit. I was not in a role where I was fundraising.
Ah, okay.
A lot of those folks are a lot more familiar kind of with the process and the dance that occurs between nonprofits and foundations. Most of my work at that time was driven like in the community, focused on getting information or resources to people. That particular nonprofit was receiving a lot of government funding. So I was familiar with the process of when government cuts begin, how that impacts your work. Because eventually that particular nonprofit had significant cuts in their funding from the federal level. And you know, eventually the staff of that organization went from about 300 people down to about 25.
Wow.
That's how drastic the cuts were. So I did know early on that money and the flow of money between foundations or the government and to the social sector is something that's very volatile and, really challenging to sustain over time.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked in the nonprofit sector before going to graduate school, and it was quite the dance. It was quite the dance. So a lot of our listeners, we've certainly heard of foundations, but give us an understanding of what foundations are, what's their purpose, how they're structured, things like that.
Sure. So when we talk about foundations, many listeners have probably heard of the Ford Foundation or the MacArthur Foundation. In your listening area, the William Penn Foundation is one that a lot of folks may have heard of. These types of organizations are really, really unique to the United States. You don't see this type of sector in other places in quite the same way. And that's because in the United States, we have a tax code that allows wealthy individuals or families or even corporations to start foundations as an sort of act of charity. And in doing so, those individuals or corporations are exempt from paying taxes on that money. So if I won the lottery today and I wanted to, instead of paying taxes on some of that money, I could actually start a foundation and that money would be sheltered from taxation. And then I would have an organization that I could then, invest money from that foundation into different nonprofit organizations that were of interest to me. So aligned with my interest areas or concerns. And so, on one hand, this seems like a fantastic, opportunity. And I don't want to take away from the role that foundations and philanthropy has played in this country, because there has certainly been a very significant role that foundations have played in supporting the safety net of services in this country, in keeping the nonprofit social sector afloat. And in investing in very important movements throughout our history, like the Civil Rights Movement. A lot of that funding to support that work was happening by some foundations, but also networks of donors who were sort of under the radar supporting the financing, that type of social change. And so there's been, you know, tremendous work that has happened through the years with these foundations being in place. However, there's, you know, sort of a new wave of questioning happening right now about the purpose of these organizations and the public benefit that, you know, that exists because as a result of their charitable status. And that's because when you, the sector of philanthropy, so the foundations that we're talking about, sit on $800 billion of money. $800 billion.
That's a lot of money.
And so now understand, again, this is $800 billion that would have gone into the public sector to support public education, safety net services like elder care and health care. But instead, this money was put into a tax-sheltered situation. So when you think about sort of democracy, you know, it's really, it starts getting a little bit gray because this is a significant amount of money that very few people have control over or say so over where that money is going. And so that's one of the questions that people are exploring right now about how really democratic is this process when wealthy folks can start foundations, get a tax break, become wealthier as a result of that. And then the money is actually under their control versus the public's control about how it's invested. So that's kind of one thing to understand as a start.
Gotcha. $800 billion is a lot of money. And you're saying that's the current estimate today of what's sitting in foundations?
That's right.
Okay.
It's almost actually $900 million at this point.
Billion.
A billion.
Billion, yeah.
Billion with a B.
So, and talk about, because that's the thing, and so, you know, I think in our community, maybe people are thinking about, okay, so the football players who are making millions and millions of dollars very often, I think they're advised to start a foundation early on. Music artists, things like that. So what are the rules? Because, again, I want to remind folks, so this is essentially a tax shelter. And so what are the rules around how much they give away and what's the reality of how much they give away?
So that's a great question because that is the part that is very kind of under the radar that most people don't understand and why there's beginning to be sort of questioning about the actual charitable benefit of these organizations. And so remember we said there's almost $900 billion with a B now. The only requirement on independent private foundations, because there's all types of foundations, but most foundations, you have community foundations where there's a different set of criteria.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, most foundations are only required by the IRS to give away 5% of their assets on a 3-year rolling average. So this means that the $800 billion that's in the bank, only 5% of that money is actually leaving the doors. On average, 5-7% on is actually leaving the doors of foundations going back into the community.
Hmm.
And so that begs the question then, well, what's happening with the 95% that's not leaving the doors?
Right. Yeah.
So what's happening there is that foundations are actually investing those resources, that corpus or those assets, in Wall Street for the most part. And so, again, this is all money that's tax sheltered. The majority of the money is not ever leaving the door or touching the community and is actually being reinvested in Wall Street. And when you look at that data, what researchers have found is that the majority of those types of investments in Wall Street are in industries that are harmful and extractive and actually not mission aligned. And so what happens is you have a foundation, for example, with their grant making, which again is the 5% that leaves the door that goes into the community, with their grant making, they might be funding criminal justice reform, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But the very same foundation with their 95% that's invested in Wall Street might be invested in private prisons,
right,
who are driving a lot of the inequities around criminal justice.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the equation of like what's happening with the majority of the funding that you don't hear about because it's invested in private industries and on Wall Street, we have to ask ourselves, what is the actual net value of philanthropy? Are these foundations existing to actually make major change in communities, or are they, do they exist to make the wealthier more wealthy, and to drive private agendas around building wealth?
Right, right. This is a question, as you're describing this, that I don't quite know. So they, let's say this is one foundation that had the $800 billion. They're giving away 5%, it sounds like annually is the rule. And then the rest is sitting there invested and it's growing. Now, can they pull some of that out and use it personally, or whatever they put in the foundation has to stay in the foundation permanently?
No, that's the thing. So the 5% rule of the money that's leaving the doors is was something that it's called the minimum payout rule.
Mm-hmm.
And the minimum payout rule was enacted by Congress in 1976. So this is how old this legislation is, 1976. Because when foundations were first started up in the country and many began popping up around that time, the money was actually not even leaving the doors. Foundations were being started, and then no funding was going into the community. So Congress actually had to enact legislation in 1976 that requires that foundations pay out a minimum of 5%, you know, to the community because, again, of the public charity situation here. And so that's, that 5%, which was intended to be the floor, mm-hmm. has become the ceiling.
Right.
And that is sort of, you know, foundations kind of pat themselves on the back because they are meeting their payout requirement.
Mm-hmm.
It was never intended to be the ceiling. And foundations do have the right to pay out more than that if they want. They can pay out as much as they want.
Okay.
So there's just the minimum requirements. There's no maximum requirement. And there has been a movement for many years now to push foundations to give above the 5%, and on and several do. On average, the payout is about 5 to 7%. So many foundations are paying out a little bit more, but the sort of hesitancy around that is to worry about, well, if we're paying out so much money, then we're not building wealth.
Okay.
So there's just a major imbalance on the focus of, are we here to build wealth and to grow our endowments? Are we actually here to put money in the community? And I would say that it's really about the former.
Okay, okay, okay. And you've got a message for them. so let's jump into the book. So the first half of your book is titled Where It Hurts. And here you talk about the injustices that were the seeds for the vast amount of wealth that exists in our country today. Tell us about that.
Sure. So going back to the data for just 1 minute, and then I'll make the connection. So we talked about the small amount of money actually leaving foundations. So this is the 5 to 7% that leaves the foundation. So I'm going to break down where that money and where that money is going, who actually receives that money in our communities. When you when we examine the data, we know that only about 7.5 to 8% of grant dollars, again, this is the overall 5%, only 7.5 to 8% of that is being given to communities of color, to nonprofits working in communities of color. And so when you look at the overall landscape of giving and where money is going, we see such a small benefit for communities of color. And I make that connection to a main point of my book because I think there's an injustice in that. In this country, the way that wealth has been accumulated in our young history is very, very closely connected to a history of colonization, slavery, exploitation of low-wage workers. To sum it up, I mean, people of color and indigenous folks in this country have had major roles in helping with the accumulation of wealth in this country. However, we are not benefiting in many ways, and we're absolutely not benefiting very much from the philanthropic industry.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's that, 2015 article from Newsweek that gave it, I think they were using just the promise, and this was just to the African-American slaves after slavery ended, and said, okay, well, you'll get 40 acres and a mule. And we know now that that never happened. I saw a film the other night, and they said, well, you know, when the president was assassinated, you know, that kind of went away. But I think that 2015 Newsweek article said, okay, if you just use that amount, it would be something like $14 trillion that is owed in, you know, and the word now being bandied around is reparations. So these are pretty astounding numbers if you just sort of, you know, even try to sort of put a calculation on that. And again, that's just, you know, one little calculation. That's not going back to the land that was, you know, the whole country that was stolen from the Native Americans. So, yeah, it's a really good point that, and so now these foundations are sitting on all of this wealth that's been built over time and are giving less than 10% of that little 5% back to communities of color. Yeah, that's pretty heartbreaking.
Yeah, it definitely feels like an injustice. And as a Native American, I know, you know, the trauma of how wealth has been accumulated in this country is still very present in my life and in my family's life, you know, where we, you know, colonization, folks often think about as something that happened long, long ago, started 500 years ago, but it's still something that's actually very active still in this country and around the globe. And in indigenous communities, for example, it was only my grandparents' generation, so we're not talking about a long time ago, Native children were removed from their homes and forced into Indian boarding schools, not allowed to speak the language, and sort of this mantra of kill the Indian, save the man. And so we are still trying to recover and organize our communities and reconnect to our culture and break through lots and lots of trauma in our communities. And so this is where we have just a major disconnect in this country, because a pervasive narrative around Native folks and around a lot of people of color is, if you would just work harder, you can achieve the American dream,
right? Right.
And so we know that it's not about hard work. We would all be doing very well. People in our communities are working very, very hard. But we are working up against generations of oppression and trauma and very intentional policies and systems that have been designed to kind of keep us in places of poverty. And so I'm asking folks who have wealth and power and privilege to understand that history, and at least through the charity sector, through the sector of philanthropy, where we are, you know, supposed to be in the business of helping others, you know, pushing for change in our communities. We should be on the forefront of folks thinking through how to move capital and wealth back into these communities, given the mission of our organizations and the resources we have at our disposal to make that happen.
Yeah, yeah. I actually posted, I try to do a little bit of advertising for the shows, and so I posted on Facebook a picture of the stack of your wonderful books, and I said, can the foundation sector lead the reparations movement? You know, I mean, because that's the thing. While I hope that we ask a lot of questions of our many candidates who are running for president, I think expecting the government to move on that is not really realistic in any time in the near future. But foundations, I mean, that's the thing. So many of them, they can do whatever they want, right? And so they can lead really well on things. They can make decisions. They can do research. They do all sorts of things. And so I think, number one, I want every single foundation to make this required reading for all their board members. But yeah, I think there's some traction I think we can pick up here. So let's move a little bit, and we may jump back to some of the first half. But the second half of your book is titled How to Heal. And you share 7 steps for decolonizing wealth. I love action steps. I love it when I read something and it's like, okay, I got my to-do list now. So thank you for that.
Right.
So let's start talking about those. And I let me list them first, and then maybe we'll jump around. Or there's a couple I definitely want you to cover, but I'll let you decide. So the first is grieve. The second is apologize. Number 3 is listen. Number 4 is relate. Number 5 is represent. Number 6 is invest. And number 7 is repair. And again, I'm here with Edgar Villanueva, the author of Decolonizing Wealth, Indigenous Wisdom to Heal Divides and Restore Balance. Which one you want to start with?
I think I'll begin by saying that I also love that there's seven steps, like sort of neatly packaged up. But we have to remember that when we are thinking about changing, you know, addressing really, really deep social problems in our country, there really is no quick solution.
Right.
And, you know, one of the takeaways from this conversation that I hope folks have is that, you know, we have to begin a journey to repair a lot of things that have happened in our country, but it is a lifelong commitment. And so I get asked often to come into institutions or to meet with folks who want to fix it by the end of that meeting.
Right.
And unfortunately, it's not that simple to repair all that has happened. But the steps to healing I outline in the book, for me, come together from my own personal journey as a Native American, as a person of color who has worked inside sort of this bubble of privilege and power and wealth for some time now. The process that I went through to sort of come to terms with that, how I have helped, how I have potentially harmed communities in my role, and the work that I needed to do to reconnect to who I was and to remember that and to center my past, my history, or my culture in my life and my leadership. And I spent time writing this book in my home community, talking to Indigenous elders, and just asking basic questions around what do we think of as philanthropy? What do we think of as being in community and taking care of one another and making sure that everybody's all right? What do we need to do to heal from this moment where this country is so polarized and at odds with one another? Is there what wisdom do you have for that? And so from all of those conversations, I was able to pull this process together that I think for all of us as individuals, but absolutely for those of us who work in institutions that are moving and controlling and allocating resources, we can also engage in this process collectively as an organization to shift our culture and our thinking around how we're using money. And so I think I'll kind of just kind of walk through and just maybe say a few things about the initial steps.
Okay.
The first step is grieve. And grieving is something that is really about stopping to understand and to feel the hurts that we've endured or we've been a part of causing. It's kind of, you know, when we think about healing, we want to move quickly to something that sounds really positive, and grieving does not sound positive. But what has not happened in the United States is that we as a nation have not really truly, you know, addressed our history in this country. We're very much a culture that wants to sweep that under the carpet and just move forward and look forward. But I think personally the reason we're seeing so much happening right now in terms of acts of hate and just blatant racism and sort of, you know, just a polarization is because we have not addressed the history of this country, and we've allowed that to that dark history and those ugly truths to sort of simmer under the surface. And all of that is beginning to boil up now. And what does that have to do with money, right? It has to do a lot with money, because when we are not, our history and its connection to money in this country is very pervasive. Like, the country was basically started on this system of colonization and slavery, and which is very deeply a part of the fabric of our economic system.
Right.
And so other countries, for example, Canada, have gone through processes of truth and reconciliation, where for a decade in Canada, people sat with First Nations folks and heard their stories and really opened their hearts and minds to understand why they were living in poverty and why they were, you know, experiencing this trauma. And as a result of that, of course, it's very heavy, and you're going to grieve if you are. This is work of the heart, and not just the mind, but work of the heart. And we need to feel that pain in order to be able to get to a place of true healing. So that's the first step. The second step is really about apologizing.
Can we go back to grieve for a moment, Edgar?
Oh,
is that all right?
Sure.
So The other night I went to a really interesting film that's going to show on WHYY, I think on April 24th. And I believe it's called Boss, and it's the history of essentially enterprise and business, African-American business in the United States. And so there's a lot to grieve back there. You know, the Black Wall Street town that was destroyed. The bank that was developed after emancipation. There was a bank for the African-Americans, and a lot of them put their money in there, and then it disappeared because the white folks who were running it essentially started using the money for other things. So the grieving is so important, I think, but it's also, and is grieving also part of making sure that everybody knows this? Because so many people, like, I had heard about, you know, sort of like little tidbits of these things, but it's like it wasn't embedded in my public school education.
Right.
And so it feels like that's really important that we have universal knowledge of these things so that, you know, people, you know, when you say to somebody who, you know, has not been born with your privilege and had, you know, that kind of history in their background, this is not about bootstraps, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? So many folks on, I mean, I know for me and many friends that I've talked to from my community, is just that acknowledgement. And it is about money and resources and what has been taken away. But ultimately, we can never, you know, repay, you know, what has been taken. And so it is about, you know, actually getting to a place of acknowledging and being visible, you know?
Yeah.
So that's really important.
Yeah. Great. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead. Step two was apologize, I think.
So the step of apologizing is really moving from sort of that internal exploration around what has happened, what is the history, what our role has been in it, and thinking to moving kind of more externally to think about who has been impacted and what we need to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in this country, I think apologies are due for where the wealth came from. Again, almost always from the depth of land and resources and exploiting you know, slaves and low-wage workers. I think apologies are due for how the wealth was maneuvered out of appropriate taxation.
Yep.
And shirked of its responsibilities there. And so this is where you see that process of truth and reconciliation. Like, first there's truth, and that you're going to feel the grief, and then reconciliation is where we begin to engage people in an apology. Just quickly, in my book, I shared a little story about a woman, a white woman with wealth, who engaged in a process with me where she explored her own history as it pertains to wealth and money. And she explored in her own family and realized that in her family, they owned slaves back in North Carolina, where I'm from, Black and Native slaves. And of course, she felt grief around this because she's a kind-hearted person and was devastated, you know, to know this. And part of her healing process was to write 15 letters of apology.
Hmm.
And one of the letters she wrote was to me, and she had given me a heads up, I'm going to write this letter to you. You don't have to respond to it, but I just need to do this. It's about me. It's not about you, but I just wanted to give you the heads up. And, you know, when I got the letter, and I shared an excerpt in the book from that letter, it really changed my life because here I am minding my own business, you know, doing my work.
Uh-huh.
I didn't feel like I wasn't or expecting an apology from anyone. And I all of a sudden got this letter. But for me as an Indigenous person to actually hear I'm sorry from someone who is taking some ownership or responsibility for her ancestors' role in what happened in this country. I felt super visible for the first time in my life.
Hmm.
Super, super visible and seen and heard. And it opened the doors for she and I to have a very beautiful relationship.
Interesting.
And so that's something as individuals we can do. We can, you know, take that journey to understand, you know, where did my privilege come from? Where did money in my family possibly come from? And how can I actually begin to Once I understand that history, how can I actually do to acknowledge or repair that history?
That's interesting. Yeah. And we're going to come, that relationship is going to come up as another theme as we go through the list. Thank you for that story. Yeah.
So the, do you want me to jump in?
Yep.
I can kind of speed through the next few.
Go ahead.
The third one is listen. And listen actually is just about bringing your whole self to a conversation and opening your eyes and your ears. Once we've gone through this process of understanding history, understanding what's, you know, what has transpired, and, you know, actually taking some action to apologize for that, we can really get into a place of deep, honest partnership with communities, with each other, with people who are very different from us.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that we're going to agree on every single thing, but we are going to be able to listen in a way that we may have not been able to listen to others before. And especially for people who work in finance and banking and philanthropy, we often have trouble listening because we walk in the door and we, you know, we have the resources, we have the power, and we do a really poor job of listening to folks and understanding that people who have actually been excluded and exploited by the system actually possess exactly the wisdom that is needed to fix it.
Right.
And so we have to, as holders of resources, acknowledge that and learn to listen to people who may not have a lot of money, but they're living on the front lines of the issues that we're trying to change in our communities,
right,
and hold so much wisdom. And so we have to put aside our own conclusions, opinions, and judgments, and really stop talking long enough for others to be able to participate in a conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then we get to relate, which, as you were talking about the apology letter that you got, you ended by saying you talked about the relationship that you have with that woman. And so when I read the relate chapter, I was like, oh yeah, this is powerful. Tell us about relate.
Yeah, so relating is getting to an authentic relationship, and that's what so much of this is about. We have with money. In our money's role in our society, and especially money and its role in philanthropy and charitable work, it's become so transactional. It is about who has money, who doesn't have money. I'm a funder, you're a grant seeker. And even in that philanthropic exchange, it's become so transactional. You know, we're reading your reports, we're doing our due diligence, and we've lost sight somewhere along the way that this work is about people, and especially for those of us in philanthropy, where the word literally means love of humankind, we have we've lost sight of how to build relationships and really relate to each other beyond the transaction.
Right.
You know, I often think of if Dr. King were alive today, he probably would have had a really hard time getting a grant from a foundation.
Huh. Tell us more about that. What do you mean?
Well, he may not have had the right type of reputation or the right type of networks into these wealthy circles.
Okay.
He may have not had the type of financial backing or assets in place that some funders require to get a grant.
Mm-hmm.
He may not have had the track record as he was starting out with the outcomes and the rigorous data that some foundations are requiring.
Yes.
And so my message to funders is that we have to look beyond all of that, all of these requirements of organizations that we've put into place, to actually take the time to connect with leaders who are really doing things on the ground. And maybe they don't fill out the best applications, or maybe they don't have the most money in the bank. And maybe they've had, their reputation might not be one that in wealthy circles everyone knows them or supports them. But when we are able to connect with people as human beings, then we're able to really, sometimes let our hearts make those decisions whereas in our, maybe on paper, doesn't feel like necessarily the right decision. And so we have to invest in those folks who are kind of on the front lines doing work that may be radical in some people's eyes, but are really, the types of leaders that we need in our communities to get us to a place of different, a change, a place of difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that leads to represent. I want to throw out the name. A lot of people here are familiar with. You mentioned like the William Penn Foundation. Here in the activist circles, most people know about Bread and Roses Community Fund, which was one of many small community foundations that was part of the funding exchange out of New York. And actually, give us a little background, because I think these were started, I think, maybe back in the 70s. And I think they started to move on some of these issues, or at least... you know, as you talk about represent, it feels like when I first got involved with Bread and Roses, it was like they were really clear on the people who are making the decisions need to represent the communities that we're trying to help.
Absolutely. So a lot of this work around decolonizing wealth is really looking at who is sitting at the table, who is getting to allocate, manage, and spend resources, who is benefiting from these resources. In order to really shift that, we have to examine those questions and think about ways to build whole new tables where we are being more democratic and reflective and inclusive and how resources are being allocated. And for me, the word that comes to mind when I think about this step is proximity.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's really interesting that in a lot of these boards that are making decisions about resources around, you know, social change and social impact in our communities are very, very far removed from the problem. You know, they don't have lived experience of living in poverty, are struggling to finish their education or whatever the issue might be that their foundation is trying to solve. And so we really have to think about how do we center people with lived experience in places that are making decisions about resources to address those problems. So I make a call in the book, you know, for foundation boards to really examine who's around the table. And again, this is a sector where there's zero accountability or requirements for who comprises a board.
Right.
And so what happens is, especially with family foundations, most of those boards are all family members.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the only reason that you get to be on that board and make decisions about money is because you're simply born into that family. And so my recommendation is that boards think about you know, having at least as a minimum half of the board should be comprised of people who have real intimate, authentic knowledge of the issues and the communities being served by those foundations. And this is something that's, this type of like requirement is not uncommon for other types of organizations.
Right.
If you are an organization that receives federal funding, like a federally qualified health center, there's a requirement that half of your board be comprised of patients from that health center.
I read that and I was like, wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, it's like, right. I've actually experienced, you know, getting healthcare here. It's really important that my voice be heard. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we really need to think about it. And what I say, the last point I'll say about represent is that often we think about representation as like, oh, I'm going to bring a seat to the table.
Right.
And so versus thinking about it that way, I would say another way to think about it is like, how do we create a whole new table?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is when we have a table that's folks with mostly privilege and you bring in one or two seats of folks who don't come from that space, the research shows that it's really hard for those folks to speak up or to really contribute because you are a minority, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're in the minority. But when we have a different type of construct where we're not creating sort of a white dominant space and inviting you to that space, but we're creating a different type of table, a whole new decision-making table that's more inclusive, everyone's going to feel comfortable about speaking up and leading at that table.
Yeah. I also like the point in the book, I think, where you make like, because I've been on, you know, sort of these groups sort of thinking about, well, how do we get more young people? And it's like, okay, then you bring one young person on. Ooh, that's pretty disempowering because it's like, you know, are they going to feel comfortable speaking with these 50-year-olds around the table? So I think you said, let's have a minimum of three, you know? It's like they need their own core. They need their sort of posse with them. So any kind of diversification is like, yeah, let's not just do the one token, you know, let's really bring in people who will feel empowered to have their voice, because you really, and that'll demonstrate that you really do want to hear that voice, right? That's important.
Absolutely.
I also want to shout out here, because I want to shout out to the organizations that I know of, and please you too, that really do seem to be on the path of doing this. And I want to acknowledge that Women's Way has been around for many, many years, funding women and girl programs in the Philadelphia region. And they are actively involved now in essentially leading subgroups that are doing some just sort of listening and sharing that will lead to essentially action steps. And each of those subgroups is made up of people with lived experience. So there's, and I had a guest on Women's Economic Security Initiative, I think it's called. And so it's women with the lived experience of living in poverty, being homeless, things like that, who are sitting around the table. And you know, they did things in order to make it, you know, easy for them to sit around the table, not having, you know, noon meetings. You know, let's have it in the evening. Mm-hmm. Let's have childcare so that those voices can actually be heard. And those are the people who are saying, this is my lived experience. If you really want to use the money to help us, here are the priorities that we need, and here's how to do that. So yeah, kudos to Women's Way.
Fantastic.
Invest in repair.
So investing is kind of going back to earlier in our conversation where we were saying that 95% of the foundation dollars are not leaving the door and going into communities, but rather are being invested in Wall Street, often in harmful and extractive industries. And so investing is, that chapter is about putting all of our money where our values are, and really aligning and making sure that we're using those resources in a way that, you know, aligns with the mission. And so there are many foundations who are looking at, well, you know, we can make grants, but how can we use this corpus of resources to actually make investments, impact investing, mission-aligned investment, to divest from industries that are counter-mission, and to, you know, actually invest in industries potentially that are reinforcing the mission. And so one foundation is called the Heron Foundation in New York City, and they were on the forefront of this. Many years ago, they decided that 100% of their assets would be invested in mission-related investment.
Excellent.
And so they're making grants, but they're also making loans and investing in startups and all types of portfolios to build wealth in communities of color. And so it's thinking about all the tools we have in our toolkit to really push forward the agenda of the foundation, and not thinking about, well, you know, doing good as a side hustle.
Right.
And I'm going to do some good with this money over here and be values agnostic about the 95%.
Right.
Like, we need to care about the impact of all of it. So that's what that chapter is really about. It's a call for us to be really, really intentional about all of the money being aligned with our values.
Yeah, and it's so important. I another shout out. So I'm involved with the Valentine Foundation, and we have a mission aligned policy, and we've recently made a decision to invest in a community development financial institution here locally that invests in Philadelphia. So yeah, CDF, and that's the thing. So it's like, okay, the money's still invested. These are not grants. Essentially, you're you know, making an investment, sometimes perhaps at a, you know, lower rate than what you might get. But the money is still available. And again, you're not just doing 5% of this $800 billion. So yeah.
Right.
Cool.
Right. One other thing I want to just note here, for folks to think about too, what's happening now with a lot of giving is actually donor advised funds.
Yep.
And I call this out a little bit in this chapter. So many folks, there's a trend to instead of starting foundations, many folks are beginning to put assets in a donor advised fund. And what that means is, if I start a donor advised fund, I still get a write-off on my taxes for the charitable contribution. And currently, there are no requirements for donor advised funds to actually be re-granted into the community.
Wow.
And so the problem that we had with foundations back in 1976, because they weren't paying out and we got that 5% rule in place, we now have the same problem happening in the donor advised fund arena.
I did not
and
know
more
that.
And more wealthy folks are, you don't even have to be wealthy, but if you have enough money to have some type of wealth advisor around your money, they are advising their clients to start donor advised funds as a way to build their wealth. And so the largest holder currently of charitable assets in the country is Fidelity Bank. They have more money than the Ford Foundation, than any other foundation, because of this trend to put money in donor advised funds. And so now I'm asking for folks to in this industry to really think about how can we put some limitations on our accountability on donor advised funds so that, that again, this is money that would have gone and been taxed is now going into these funds and being managed by financial institutions. And we as the public are not getting any benefit from that. So this is another call to action in the invest chapter of the book.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, that's unacceptable. Very interesting. All right. Wow. This, our hour is flying away. Tell us about repair. And then I want to squeeze in a couple more questions there.
So repairing is just really thinking about how do we use money to heal where people are hurting and to stop more hurt from happening. So again, kind of looking back on our history to thinking about our role as financial institutions, as donors, as foundations, even you know, folks who may not have wealth, we all make decisions every day about money, even if it's $5, where am I eating lunch today, right? We have the opportunity to use money to actually help heal versus hurting or to stop hurt from happening by decisions that we make. And so for foundations in particular, the call is to understand that the wealth has come from extraction in many cases and to think about, you know, it's not the wealth problem. Money is not bad. Money is not evil, right? It's not, money is not the root of all evil. It's the love of money, as the Bible says. And as we know that money has been used to harm in the past as connected to colonization, which was very much about dividing and oppressing and conquering, we have the power to flip that and use money and to use wealth in a way that helps to facilitate healing and reconnection and balance in the world. And so I have this idea of using money as medicine. In the indigenous sort of worldview of medicine being something that's sacred, mm-hmm. for a sacred purpose, and to help restore, you know, good energy and good balance in the world. So that's really what decolonizing wealth is in a nutshell. It's using money as medicine, as a tool to help repair what has happened over time through acts of colonization.
Yeah. And that's so clear in the book. Thank you for that. So a lot of people, a lot of our listeners in particular, don't really have connections to foundations. They're not on the boards. They're not yet on those wonderful Women's Way advisory committees sharing their experiences. But, you know, they might have a job where they make an okay amount, and each year they're making decisions about where to give their money. And throughout the year, they're spending money. So talk about particularly that last piece on repair. How can individuals do this, not just foundations? How do you see individuals taking these steps in order to use money as medicine?
You know, I think one of the first things you can ask yourself is, where are you banking?
Mm-hmm.
What are the values of the bank where you're choosing to put your money? And that's a really powerful decision that we all hold. And so there are banks who have been not kind towards certain communities, mm-hmm. Have had practices in the past. I think many are trying to repair that and do better. There's a movement within the banking world, we know. But where you choose to bank means a lot. So know the values of your bank. Understand what your bank might be doing to help or harm the community, especially maybe the community that you're from. And so personally, I bank at a credit union.
There you go.
The bank has a foundation that, you know, gives back. those mm-hmm. types of things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And where you shop, a wonderful show I had a couple of months ago, I think, I had three different credit union, co-op leaders. And so we talked about all sort of kinds of co-ops, including, you know, a credit union as a kind of co-op. But we had Emily Weiner, who has been leading the fundraising effort and loan effort to open South Philly co-op. And I know they recently opened, so shout out to them. Co-ops, you know, it's sort of like, where do you choose to buy your food? You know, REI, it's a co-op, you know, where do you choose to buy your shoes? So things like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That really, really matters. And, you know, I try in my practice personally, but also at work when we are looking for vendors, even a caterer, right? Are we making the conscious decisions to make sure we're being inclusive, to have vendors led by people of color, Black-owned businesses, for example? All of these are opportunities for us to use our own money and the resources from our institutions to really be intentional about directing those towards communities that have been marginalized through the years, for sure.
And that reminds me of another point that the film made the other night. And I'm going to load up the link to the film that's going to come on WHYY onto my website. There was one young man on the panel, so they showed a good bit of the film, and then there was a panel of Black entrepreneurs. And one young man was a tech guy, and he developed an app to help. It was essentially a directory on an app of all Black businesses, particularly in the Philadelphia area, but also in some other countries, I believe. I think it was called Kanata. I wish I remember that, but again, I'll load it up. And so that led to a conversation about and like the film talked about, the founder of Ebony, when he went to buy the building, he dressed as a janitor and took a white man, because once word got out that there were Black people heading up these businesses, many of these businesses failed, right? And so, you know, hopefully we have evolved since then, but still there is, you know, some of our own internalized racism often keeps us from interacting with and supporting our own institutions. And so, you know, things like that app and, you know, just trying our best to really support each other, as we move through, you know, these challenges that we have as, you know, people who have been, you know, colonized and enslaved and still trying to operate in this world with pride and power, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, again, I'm here with Edgar Villanueva. He is the author of Decolonizing Wealth. So give us a last thought before we have to go away. Edgar, I'm so glad you're here with us, but what final thoughts do you have for our audience?
Well, I appreciate everyone listening in today, and Vanessa, thank you for the opportunity. You know, I think I'll leave you with the idea that, you know, we all have a responsibility in making things right. This is not a white, Black, Native kind of issue. We've all arrived at this place in our country with, you know, things are what they are,
right.
But we have to be aware of that history and understand that we all have a role in the process of healing. Whether we have caused harm or we've received more harm, there's a Lakota value that, or sort of a philosophy that I'll leave you with that I love, and that is that all my relations, and that means that all of our suffering is mutual, and all of our healing is mutual, and all of our thriving is mutual.
Thank you for that, and thank you for being with the show. Stay tuned. On May 4th, I'll have Michelle Brown Nevers, and we'll be talking about college access and tools for paying for college. Also, tax season is technically over, but for those who still need to go to a site, the North Central Financial Center is still open. So congratulations to all of you who got your taxes done, but I know some may still have that to do. You've been listening to Vanessa's Money Hour on Germantown Community Radio, WRLGLP at 92.9 FM in Northwest Philadelphia. Thank you so much for being with us. ¶¶